Hello, everyone. Welcome to Jill Trebilcock Does Something or Something Else. Hello, everyone in the chat box. Today we have Ian Lillington again, the Permaculture Whiz who we had last week. We discovered that there was a lot of interest in the chat box about alternative currencies. So Ian, actually, I met, as I explained before, when we had a Let's Scheme in Daylesford, Australia, where we did lots of, there's lots of banging going on in the background, I don't know who it is, where we had lots of interest in, you know, Let's. What does Let's, anyway, welcome Ian, let's explain what Let's is.
Hello, Jill. Yeah, it's good to be here. It's a beautiful sunny morning in central Victoria, but we've also had some rain, the first significant rain for about 6 months, so that's a really good news from this part of the world.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, go on.
Oh, well, look, I got involved in alternative currencies through this thing called Let's. Let's is the name, Let's stands for Local Energy Trading Systems or Local Economic Trading Systems. Let's is like a club and you can trade between members of the club. And you don't have to do direct swaps. So it's better than a simple barter, because if you want apples and I only have pears, then we can't do a swap. But if I can sell my pears to someone else in the local community and they can then do something else and then they can sell you the apples, then it becomes a small scale local trading system. And we keep records of those trades. And so within a given community, the exchange keeps on happening. So it's a little bit like a financial exchange, but instead of your money being able to be taken and away from the community, it keeps all the trade and all the energy in the local community.
Yeah, it was absolutely fabulous. I just really loved it. I had, I think I told you, one day I found 600 lets in some dockets I had. I taught horse riding. Other people got houses built. I did horse riding and massaging is the way I and I got thousands of dollars in Let's, and it's completely free money.
Yeah, it's better called community credit. It's where you you put faith in your community. The thing with any kind of alternative currency, well, the thing with any currency, it has to be underwritten by somebody believing in something. There has to be some backing to the currency. Until about 50 years ago, our mainstream currencies were backed by gold. There was a gold standard. Now mainstream currencies are really backed by oil and fossil fuels and all the resources that are mined. But a local currency can be backed, either by trust in your neighbors because you're really trusting that they're going to give back into that local credit system in the way that you've given to it. And some local currencies are backed by federal money as well. So as well as Let's, what's evolved recently is much greater use of people printing their own money. Local communities actually print their own money. So in England, there are various towns and cities that now have their own pound, their own pound notes. In some parts of the states, there are dollar systems. There's only one in Australia that I know of in northern New South Wales where they've printed their own currency. This is a little bit like the Let's system, but the exchange is actually happening with folding money, because people really do love having folding money in their pocket and changing it and swapping it. The Let's systems. Quite a few Let systems still work, but they're administratively a little bit difficult. Someone has to voluntarily put a fair bit of time into tracking those transactions. If you have cash in your pocket, if you have a £10 note and you're in Brixton in London, you can spend your sort of British pound or you can spend your Brixton pound. But only certain shops are going to accept that Brixton pound. But if they happen to be selling what you want, then you can use that local currency, and the local currency stays in the community. So whether Let's is like having a checkbook, and local currencies are actually having the folding money in your pocket.
I just love that idea. I think it's an absolutely brilliant idea because I just love the idea of having all sorts of different sorts of money. Like, what a way to create your own currency, like create your own world. I can't think of the words for it, but it's very empowering, isn't it, to have different – you could have three different sorts of money, couldn't you?
Yes. Yes, and some people do. In 2006, there was a worldwide study of complementary currency systems, and there were over 150 complementary currency systems reported in that report. A complementary, it's a bit like the medical world. You know, there's mainstream medicine and there's what sometimes is called alternative medicine. But because the word alternative comes, you know, tinged with quite strong negative views for some people, there's been this tendency to call non-mainstream medicine, to call it complementary medicine. So the same with currency. The fashion now has been to call it complementary currency rather than alternative, because these other currencies are not meant to do away with mainstream money, not in the short term anyway. They're meant to complement it. So you can be trading in a number of different currencies at any one time. And it's because you're likely to have to pay your electricity bill in mainstream money, but you can, as you said before, you could pay for horse riding lessons, or in some cases you pay for carpentry or bread baking. You can pay for those sorts of things in a local currency, and it complements the mainstream currency.
So, and it gives, and when you've got the folding money, it gives away with, it gets away, which we, it's like a monopoly money, which ordinary money's like now anyway. It gives away with all the bookkeeping that you need to do. Could you get caught? Yeah, go on.
No, you go on.
Well, there's a lot of bookkeeping, you said, and I think you did most of it back 30 years ago when I, was it about 30 years
only,
ago?
Only 20 years ago, and I did do a fair bit of it, yes, which switched me on to these alternative currencies where I didn't have to do the bookkeeping.
Yeah, exactly. And but is it illegal?
Well, the legal question is fairly simple, because it's simple in a sad way, really, because things like LET systems and these other complementary currencies are such small drop in the ocean compared to the amount of money moving globally that tax office and other parts of government, for example, those making welfare payments, they're really not very interested, because these are the sums that are being traded are very small if you look at the global economy. Even the biggest of the LET systems or the biggest of the complementary currencies are talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars at most. They're not even reaching $1 million turnover. So some of the most successful systems that print their own money, they have not yet printed $1 million worth of money. Now, although $1 million sounds a lot to me or you, if you spread that between 1,000 people, then it becomes $1,000 each. So $1,000 in $1,000 in a year, if you're doing that in your own alternative currency, it's probably less than 10% of your total transactions. Yeah. And there are two specific things to guard against. In terms of the legalities, there are two specific things. One is that the people who print their own money have to be very clear that they are not trying to counterfeit the mainstream money. So the alternative notes look pretty alternative. They're usually designed by members of the local community. So the artwork is done by local people, and they don't look anything like the British pound or a federal dollar or anything like that.
Yeah. So they're called currency rather than money, are they?
Well, yes.
Lee in the chat box is wondering that. He's saying, are you defining money and currency in the same genre?
Well, that's one of the ways to make that distinction. But but really, when it comes to printing your own notes, then increasingly the mainstream banks actually now they now recognize that local communities want to do that. And the city of Bristol in England, for example, when they decided they wanted to print their own notes, they teamed up with a local credit union. The credit union manager in turn took them along to meet one of the Bank of England officials, and they had this really informative chat. It was a really good exchange between people who were seen as quite radical, marginal traders, and between the stiff officials of the Bank of England and wearing their suits. But they actually found they had a lot in common because they were all interested in money. So calling it currency or calling it money isn't really what's going to make a difference to whether you're on firm ground or not. What's going to make a difference is that you are clearly not pretending to counterfeit the mainstream money. That's one of the rules. That's when it comes to printing. When it comes to printing local currency, the second is that if you are going to use a complementary currency of any sort to and you're going to use it in your main business, then you are potentially liable to pay tax on it. So, I run a small business pruning fruit trees. If I take some of my income in the local currency, because that's my main business, I'm actually in business as a fruit tree pruner, then I'm liable to pay tax on any income I get, whether it comes in apples or in local exchange units or in a local dollar or in a federal dollar. But obviously, it gets quite hard to keep track because those transactions are usually very small. If someone says to me, prune my fruit trees and I'll give you a load of apples when they come in, theoretically, I can put a cash value on those apples and I should declare that as income because that's my business. But if so many trades that people do in these complementary currencies are just things that people would do anyway as a hobby or as a normal part of their daily life, and it's not part of a registered business. So if you're trading and you're not part of it, and it's not part of your business, you don't have to pay tax on it and you don't have to declare it as income.
So those are the
two basic rules. I mean, there's a lot of detail, of course, and it does vary from country to country, but essentially, there's actually three big considerations. Firstly, we are only talking about a very small percentage of total economic activity. So there's not a lot of interest from the mainstream in what we're doing. Secondly, it's okay to print local dollars as long as you're not pretending that you're not trying to make them look like the real thing. And thirdly, you've got to be clear whether you're in business or not, because if you are a registered business, and then any income is income for tax or welfare purposes. But all of those things really don't stop the fun of trading somehow in local currency.
Yeah, right. So if you call it a token, what does that that's an okay thing to call it?
Yeah, well, it's okay to call it anything, but but if you're you said you offered horse riding lessons. If that was a registered business, and that when you got cash payments, you were meant to pay tax, then whether you got a token or whether you got a bridle or whether you got local dollars, you were still meant to declare that for tax. But most things people offer in complementary currencies are actually not their main business. They're things they like to do at weekends or things they like to do because they purely like to do them, not things they have to do. And this is one of those ways that mainstream money is distinguished from complementary money, because complementary money is very, very often about recording the things that we like to exchange with people rather than the things that we have to exchange with people. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I think it's good. And I think the thing that I like most about it, you know, like it's just so nice to separate the sort of so-called state sanctions and the taxes and all those sorts of things, like just have nothing to do with it. Like just the thing I like about it is the way it's just a completely like alternate world in which you just walk around with your own freedom and just exchange things. And that's just so much more ability to thrive without being locked into the overseers, you know, the overlords or whatever things that people, you know, merely labeled by the mind, of course, but such a big label that we've had to talk about it as though, well, it exists on a relative level, and it definitely exists very strongly, you know, like we have taxes, we have people watching us, we have mortgages, we have whatever we have.
The complementary currencies and let systems have tended to occur in the areas of our different countries where there's also a lot of back to the land type activities where people are stepping outside of the mainstream, often physically, by moving out of the cities into the hinterland of the cities. So, you know, there's always 1 or 2 hours drive out of Melbourne, out of Sydney, out of New York, out of London. You find people living, in fairly rural areas, trying to grow some of their own food, increasing their involvement with local community, but still keeping in touch with the big city that's nearby. And that, these are areas where you'll find let systems as well, or alternative currency systems.
So, we don't seem to have one in Daylesford, do we? Like, wouldn't it be good? Like, you go to the farmers market, and everything apart from the chooks are really expensive.
Well, there's various kinds of farmers markets, and what you and I experience around Southeast Australia are what I really call tourist markets. They're where the farmers meet the tourists, and once a month. Yes. That's not where you or I do our weekly or our daily shopping. They're not like European traditional markets where you actually go twice a week to buy your fresh fruit and vegetables and meat and fish. So our farmers markets at the moment are a good place to meet farmers, and they're a good place often for people who are not local to our area to meet farmers. So there is an educational value and there's an economic value, but for me, they're pretty limited in terms of actually wanting to go along and get useful produce, because the farmers markets only happen once a month. That's partly because we've actually got better markets that happen once a week, and they're not strictly farmers markets, but we do have markets where you can go on a Saturday morning or a Sunday morning, and some of the stalls there are farmers and some of the produce there is locally grown. So that's about doing your research and being, if you're devoted enough to find local food, you can find it. But in terms of how you pay for it, there's very few people can accept anything other than mainstream money or mainstream currency.
Yeah, well, I wish that we could activate. Go on.
Yeah, well, there are questions. I think there are very interesting questions about why do alternative currencies pop up, or whether you're going to call them alternative, and whether they're folding money or kind of digital systems or exchange systems. They do, in these last 20 to 30 years, those systems have tended to come at the time when the economy is not running really well. So, for example, let systems in our area were at their best in the early 90s, which was the last time Australia had a recession. Well, like, the recession is a controversial word, but you know, our governments round about the early 90s decided that we were having a recession. That was the time when let systems were most popular. More people looked to an alternative when the mainstream economy wasn't growing. Since over these last 20 years, Australia's economy has been growing every year. So the attitude or the tendency is, well, that the mainstream if the mainstream economy is working, but it's not working perfectly, but for many people it's working.
Charlie and Fifi have found somebody to bark at. Oh, we seem to have lost you for the moment.
I'm just trying to cut the dogs out of the conversation.
I think it's the
local tax office coming around, actually.
That's the thing. You have to be careful, don't you, when you talk. I'm like, I was even wondering whether to bring up the veggie boxes. You sort of wonder about what you can actually talk about on radio sometimes, don't you?
Oh, well, yeah, I feel actually completely comfortable because I'm following those rules that I mentioned before, you know, that I'm not pretending that my money is, I'm not trying to trick the system. What I'm doing is measuring local exchange, and I'm not hiding anything. But what I was about to say before the dogs came in was that, there's a lot of effort to set up an alternative currency. So these groups that have set up and printed local money have had to do a lot of work behind the scenes.
Yes.
And you actually have to invest, mainstream money to even print alternative money. So there's quite an effort there. So putting it another way, there's no such thing as a free lunch. You can't get something for nothing. So you have to be pretty clear that if you want to go into some kind of alternative currency, then it's got to be worthwhile, because you're going to put a fair bit of energy in up front to get the system going. So this is where the LET systems that we talked about earlier, they're very lightweight to set up. There is ongoing administration, but the initial establishment of them is really just photocopying a few pages and announcing that it's going to happen.
Well, the thing that I really, yeah, go on.
Well, but actually printing money, you do have to do some negotiation. You do have to have a link with a credit union. You do actually have to run a competition to get your notes designed and so on. So none of these things, none of these structured alternatives come easily. So the final alternative that remains to do what we always used to do and have done for centuries, which is to say to the local cabbage grower, I really like your cabbages, but I haven't got any money at the moment. Can I come and weed your cabbages sometime and you pay me in cabbage? So none of this is meant to totally substitute good old fashioned exchange with your neighbors and business people in your community.
Yeah, whereas the radical in me, which is very normal really, is that I want to substitute it all. But of course at the moment that can't be done. But we are a transition society. I think we're transitioning anyway. What do you think?
Well, there's no doubt that we're transitioning. I mean, change is the only constant, and the speed of change these days is faster than ever. And that's a big deal. It means that no one alternative is right. And we have to live with many, complementary and sometimes contradictory things going on. So, We have to work out how to trade in the mainstream economy at the same time as do what we can to trade in these alternative systems.
Well, you've really done that in the last few years. Like, I've been really impressed with the way that you and your partner have managed to buy and sell properties and do them up, and now you're in a very comfortable position, and it's all just been in the last 5 years, hasn't it?
Well, yes. Over the last 5 years, we have been doing what I would call eco-renovation of properties, because everyone needs a roof over their head, and most of our housing stock is really inadequate. So we have bought one, we bought a house that hasn't had insulation in the roof, for example. We've put insulation in the roof. We've blocked up the drafts, and we've made it much more comfortable to live in. And then we've sold it, and we've invested that money in buying the next place. So, you know, one house at a time, we're changing the housing stock around the world. And other people are doing that as well. Unfortunately, a lot of renovation of houses is not eco-friendly. It's quite the opposite. But, that's about doing the bit that we can. But I think, that's partly, that's a good example of how you can, make change for the better, by making your house more, a better performing house, and by having a rainwater tank and solar panels on the roof and fruit trees in the garden. If you then sell that house or you rent it to someone else and then you go and do it again, it means that you've got two families and then three families and then four families living in better housing stock than they previously would have. But in terms of these, in terms of exchange with your community, I think that it's a fundamental attitude. It's not so much whether it's with buying or selling a house or trading in cabbages. It's actually looking for the opportunity to do things other than in mainstream money. A lot of people feel restricted and limited because they don't think they've got enough money. I feel restricted just because I haven't got enough time and enough imagination to trade with other people. Even 15 years ago, I met an accountant who was a parent at the school when I had a young child there. I needed an accountant to help me with my annual tax return. And after a conversation with him, I found out what he needed was firewood. So instead of paying him $200 to do my tax, I gave him $200 worth of firewood. Now, that wasn't something he was going to advertise, and it wasn't something that would generally be known. But because I approached my neighbors and the parents at my kids' school with an attitude that we've each got something to offer each other. And that through conversation, you can find out what it is you can offer that's useful and vice versa. So I think it's important to be imaginative and to look for those opportunities, because it doesn't have to be the specific examples don't have to be what we're talking about here today. It's about that creative thinking that anybody can apply anywhere.
And it's a permaculture principle, isn't it? Because the way that it works is it's so tied into local community. And I think that's what's sort of really, really important.
Yes, it is. The thing I keep coming back to, though, as we have this conversation, what I'm thinking about is how complementary currencies are a bit like biodiesel or a bit like solar panels. Generally, they're only going to become big news when we really, really need them. And at the moment, although we know there are problems with the mainstream money systems, for most people, they believe that the mainstream money system is the only thing that's working. It's only when these big systems collapse or they show signs of collapse that then we start to look at the alternatives. In Argentina, how long is it since Argentina had its big economic meltdown? Maybe it's 10 years now.
Yeah.
But after that meltdown, then local currencies and local exchange methods became the norm. But the problem was that they weren't planned. They were things that people had to do in a crisis. And that whether it's our response to global warming or our response to keeping our food local or our response to having local money, the problem or the challenge is how much of this can we put in place before the crunch really comes?
That's what I reckon. I agree with that. I think we should be putting them in place now because the crunch has already come.
Mm. The trouble is, if there's no perception that the crunch has come, then it hasn't come in one way. For example, during 2008, leading up to the beginning of the global financial crisis, oil prices were increasing rapidly. There was a number of reasons why oil prices were increasing, but a lot of it was about perception rather than any change of substance. But during a time when oil prices were going up and petrol would increase each week, then there was a lot of talk about biodiesel, and there was a lot of talk about peak oil, about the fact that we have used up half or more than half of the world's oil resources.
Absolutely.
And so you could get stories in the news about peak oil. And you could get stories about biodiesel being a real alternative. But after the GFC kind of did its stuff and oil prices actually came down, because there was actually a smaller demand for oil because a lot of factories had closed and a lot of people were living in cold houses because they couldn't afford to heat them, then the conversations about biodiesel and peak oil were no longer high visibility. Now, there are people around me who know exactly how to run their cars on biodiesel, which they can make from cooking oil at the back of a chip shop, or they can make it from plants.
But you need a hell of a lot. You need a hell of a lot of chips.
You do. So how do we? But whilst there's a perception that there's plenty of regular petrol, and that it's going to go on being available at the same price. There's this disconnect between the people who know how to make biodiesel and to run vehicles on it, and it's not happening in reality, because it's too easy to go on with business as usual. In terms of transition, that challenge happens over and over, comes up over and over.
Yeah, well, that's where, you know, like, if only we'd listen to Tesla, you know, like, there's just so many ways that, like, we should be levitating, shouldn't we, really, by now?
Yes, yeah. Look, there's two websites I'd like to point people to, because in terms
just
of...
Just paste them into Skype, and I'll actually put them in the chat box now.
Sure, we'll do that, but I'll mention them anyway, because for people who want to research more about actually printing money, they need to go to the Bristol Pound website. This is Bristol in England, Bristol. And Bristol is a city of about 500,000 people. And their way they've gone into printing their local currency, the Bristol Pound, is a great example of how to pursue that. And the other place people should go to in terms of transition generally, and these debates that we're just having, is the Transition Towns Network, and they're based in Totnes in England, Totnes. Totnes is a very small town, but it's one of those greeny towns where a lot of these things are experimented with. So if you look up Transition Towns and you go to Totnes, Totnes, then you'll find a lot of great blog material about the sorts of things that we're talking about now.
Okay. So Totnes, you reckon? And you better say something. We've got a very naughty chat box here today. And not only that, I won't even say it. I will not speak about you, chat box. I think I'll turn you off.
Are there some questions there we should be addressing?
Well, Vin's being very naughty, actually, and I'm not going to say what Vin's talking about. There are questions, but they're further back now. Just keep going. But, the chat box has gone off on a tangent, and they're more worried about FEMA at the moment, I think.
Okay.
They were very engaged for a little bit there, but this is why I have to ignore them. I'm best to minimize them. That's what I have to do, is minimize them. But back to the permaculture principle of economy, I think, you know, from what I understand about permaculture, it's looking at natural systems and how they work. And what I'm really interested in is how this all fits together ecologically, because like a biosystem, you're like, people, like, I've often had this argument, even in some people in the chat box who may not be there at the moment, who actually talk about things, saying that it doesn't matter, the planet can handle, you know, all of this, but, all of this extreme population and blah, 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 blah. But the way I'm trying to fit this all together now, Ian, what I'm trying to say is, it is about ecosystems and feedback systems. And Stephen, that's your phone. You've got to learn to turn your phone off, I think, Ian. Now, I like the song. What's the tune? How Gentle Is the Rain? Something like that. So it looks as though I just have to keep talking to myself for a minute.
It wasn't me, Jill.
Did we lose Ian?
I don't know.
It was my phone. I'm sorry, but I don't know how to shut that one up. And that
you
phone,
can sit on it. It might give you a thrill.
Well, that phone rings about once a month, but the last two times I've been on the radio, it's rung. So it's just one of those Sod's Law, isn't it? Is that what they call Sod's Law?
I thought they called it Murphy because they're all Irish.
Well,
Murphy's Law.
Yeah.
Go on.
Anyway, it's the joys of doing radio from your own home. I remember saying last week how amazing this technology is, but it's not the same as sitting in a soundproof studio. Okay. Well, Jill, you're asking, or you're speculating.
Yeah, I'm speculating. I'm just saying the importance. I mean, it's all pretty apparent. It's the importance of creating our own economy, but it's also the importance of eating local food. That's the thing that's in my mind today, is just the importance of why there's two things that are in my mind. One is surplus, right? Like, one of the basic principles of permaculture is always create a surplus for sharing. Mm. I love that. And I was watching a film last night on a woman who'd inherited her family farm, and the father had kept a lot of the woods anyway, so there was a lot of the biodiversity there. But I was thinking how hard it is for some people to set up, well, look at your property at the moment, to set up a whole ecosystem, especially, you know, because you're in a new property at the moment. It takes ages to get everything flowing sort of within each other. And then when you have this great big sort of overlord, is what I want to keep calling it, called the government, which is really meant to be working for us, but it instead is enslaving us, just how important it is to get your own little microcosms happening within your own family, within your own home, within your own garden, within your own community, and within your own financial sort of economy, and just create many little kingdoms in a way, isn't it?
Mm.
Your every community becomes its own.
Shall we get started?
Its own. I can't. If you could see my hands, you might be able to read them. I just can't find the word for it. I'm very kinesthetic at the moment, but yeah.
Yeah, look, that's all fine. Let me see if I can respond.
I'm just talking about the importance of putting energy back into our own locality with money. I think that is so incredibly important. Would you like to expand on that?
This sounds like a tangent, but it's not. I've been a little bit involved in meditation, but nothing like enough. But what I've realized with different meditation programs is that you focus on something very specific and very local, like looking at the flame of the candle, and you simultaneously are focused on the whole universe, you know, the infinite universe all around. And when in teaching permaculture, I try to get people to realize that they have to simultaneously focus on something very specific that might be a small seed that they're planting. Because if you want a lettuce, you plant a very small seed in a very precise place. But at the same time, you're doing that, you're surrounded by this, by at least the whole of our globe, and beyond that, the universe. So, on our planet at the moment, we've got around 7 billion people, and the number is still growing, so I'm told. But yeah. I have no way of really confirming that, because I can't see 7 billion people all at once.
Mm.
And if I did, it would probably, you know, just make me crazy. But so at the same time as knowing that there's this sort of heavy load of people drawing on the resources of the planet, I have to do something that is local, that's within my grasp. And that might mean planting a vegetable, or, having a conversation with somebody, or, all those normal little daily things that I do. And in relation to my own health, and in relation to my family and my community. So
that's right.
People I see who are somehow successful at managing to live more sustainably have found some kind of balance between doing these small local things and also keeping your eye on the big picture. It's the classic think globally but act locally.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, so my particular choice is to live in a town, not live in the bush, but to live in a town, that's big enough to have basic resources like shops, schools, post office, hospital, but a town that's small enough for me to know perhaps 10% of the population, not to know them well, but to recognize and be recognized by perhaps 1,000 other people who basically live around this area as well.
Well, if there's anything I'd really like to do, and that is really, I could tell my own story. This summer, I didn't water my garden enough. I got lost in Radioland, and everything died apart from the rhubarb, more or less. The rhubarb only survived because it was a very special king rhubarb, and I went out and tipped, of water on it every now and then, even though I have hoses, and I kept the daphnia. Everything stayed. A lot died and a lot saved lives. So just recently I've just put in a heap of things for winter, like broad beans, beetroot, silver beet, kale, rockets, all sorts of different things, and it's just so rewarding. And I also had some cuttings for some hedges, and I planted a couple of hedges. They're only little, a rosemary one and a privet one, and I've forgotten the name of this other plant, but it comes in purple, and I hate the purple, but I like the pink. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. Anyway, it's just so rewarding, and I think of all the, everybody who's listening, who all have their own front yards and their own backyards, and they could actually be turning them into little paradises. And making different rooms in their own garden, and creating miniature little permaculture farms, with all these vegetables in amongst the flowers. Oh, I put in some beautiful Tibetan flowers too. Those flowers people call stock. In Tibet, they call them tara flowers because they have the most exquisite perfume. But anyway, my garden went to rack and ruin, but it held all its bamboo and, all the other things, that sort of hedges and things that hold it together. But now, it's thriving, or it's thinking about thriving again. And it's so unbelievably important and rewarding to have your own magic happening around your own home. But what do you reckon?
Yes, and it's fine for that to include flowers as well as fruit and vegetables. And it can be done on a very small scale. You don't need anything more than some plants in pots on the windowsill. If that's all you've got, you can actually make a garden on a balcony or on a windowsill, because that magic is still happening. If you've got a bigger space, then I think you have a duty to use that space to be as productive as possible. And that, yes, most of us in more wealthy countries are looking out on lawns and landscaped areas that are very unproductive, and that it would be fairly easy to make them productive. But I think we come back again to that question of, whilst we are living in relatively wealthy situations, most people don't have the incentive to break out of their business as usual model, whether it's to go and set up an alternative economy or to grow their food locally.
But absolutely.
From a permaculture point of view, then growing some food locally is perhaps all you need to do to make the local economy happen, because we all eat every day. And if you grow an excess, an abundance of food, most people who do that want to share it. People don't like seeing food go to waste. People want to share. If you get an abundance and you share it, then you're actually making the local economy happen.
Okay, I just completely and utterly agree. Now, look, I'm just going to search for something that Stephen's asked me to look for, but I've just put a question in the chat box there. It's about chemtrails. It's slightly off target. And the question is, does your guest have a solution, spiritual, universal, metaphysical or otherwise, on how we can stop those aircraft spraying mysterious toxins upon our heads? And how would you suggest we call to the universe in this quest? Thanks. But anyway, it's there for you to read. And just while you're thinking about it for a second, when I was a kid, my father had a friend who worked for the CSIRO, and they were seeding clouds then. Now, I'm going back 50 years, and I remember that they were very proud that they were seeding the Commonwealth Something Serum Laboratories in Australia at the CSIRO is. And they were very proud that they could control the weather. But I don't know why the hell they're controlling the weather the way they are at the moment. Some people seem to think that they're controlling the weather because they want to ruin there's all these theories. I've got no idea. What do you know about chemtrails? I know I see them in the sky. And what would you like to say about that?
Yeah, well, these discussions come up periodically, and I think that firstly, people have to realize just how much air traffic there is. I think people don't realize how much normal air traffic there is, and that on certain days under certain weather conditions, the normal trails from aeroplanes do stick around in the sky and do remain visible for a very long time, because it actually depends on the upper atmosphere winds as to whether they blow away or don't. And so I live about 15 minutes flying time from a major international airport. There's hundreds of planes going over quite near here. Mostly I don't hear them, because by the time they get here, they're high enough for me not to hear. And if the wind in the upper atmosphere is doing what it's normally doing, those trails from the planes blow away almost immediately. But when it's very still, they hang around, and they don't all go in the same direction. So it looks like there are days when the sky is crisscrossed with those trails.
Yeah, but now, the point is they do it. Like they do chemtrails.
No,
I'm gullible, I believe it.
If there is some cloud seeding happening some places sometimes,
but in Australia it's different to America. Sorry to talk over you for a second.
Yeah, but there's a big lack of evidence, and I think people are making a big leap that when they see all those trails in the sky, because it's just normal air traffic, and that they know that there's also some things being purposely sprayed in the sky, there's a tendency to think that one is automatically linked with the other. I think that there's a lot of psychology here that's actually nothing to do with chemical trails being purposely put up there. I think that there's mainly it's a link between people's fear of what might be happening and what we're actually seeing. The major problem, the major threat to our sustainable life on Earth, is the amount of air traffic that's happening anyway. Every day, people are flying from Melbourne to Sydney, and other people are flying from Sydney to Melbourne just to do the same job. There's computer salespeople flying from Melbourne to go and sell computers in Sydney. There's people flying from Sydney to go and sell the same computers in Melbourne. Each day, every day, those kind of transactions are being repeated over and over. And that, you know, every major city of the world has got these thousands of domestic flights every day happening. That's, you know, that's a huge effect on global warming and on a huge threat to our, you know, possibility of living sustainably on Earth.
Yeah, Jillian's kind of dropped off there, so I don't know. We just need to take a few seconds here, or trying to get her back.
Well, she's been gone.
She just had her internet man there, and she said the guy was only there for 3 minutes or something. I don't know. Earlier on today.
Okay.
Or there this morning. So I don't know. Seems to be failing the call there.
There's a bit of Skype noise. Can she get back in when she's able, or do you have to call her?
She
back
should be able to, yes.
Okay.
So your pups are having a good time in the background there, huh?
Oh yeah, they're just annoying. And when somebody goes past, they start barking. But I thought they were outside, but they were inside. So anyway, so what's going to air right now?
You and I.
That's good. I'm pleased. I should just keep talking about the state of the world then.
Yeah, just go ahead and keep on talking.
Well, I can't see the chat box, and Jill's turned off the chat box. I'm not surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if Chemtrails has got a lot of responses, though.
Here in America, I guess there is one statement here or a question. Haven't they admitted that they're geoengineering yet? Ah, Jill, you're back.
Yeah, I think Jill's coming back.
She's back.
Yeah, I made a comeback. come back just in time to say, look, I don't know what you said, but I do. I know that there's a lot of evidence that there are chemtrails, and I don't know what the reasons for them are. I haven't got into them. I know Joanne McComb from down the road here is really into them, and she keeps sending me stuff about chemtrails, and that is local. But anyway, we probably can't stay on this topic for long, but go on. You two were in the middle of a conversation, so you two talk for a second.
Was just a question from the chat. I give it to him.
There's no doubt that there's experimenting going on with spraying things into the atmosphere, but I would say that that's a very small number of flights and a very small effect on what's going on around us. And it's my observation is that when my Facebook page lights up with concerns about chemtrails, it's one of those days when we have meteorologically very calm conditions. And so people just see a lot of trails up there. And it's a bit like when people see me with a chainsaw, they're surprised, because most people who don't cut their own firewood, for example, and don't prune trees, they associate chainsaws with the destruction of forests. But my chainsaw is a constructive tool, because I actually make things with my chainsaw, like I make better fruit trees, for example. And so when people see trails in the sky, and because they're naturally fearful of chemicals being sprayed into the atmosphere, they tend to think that there's this massive amount of manipulation going on there in the atmosphere. And what they'd rather and I think it's an opportunity to it's an opportunity to deny the addiction that our modern society has to air travel.
Righto. So it seems to me as though you've got you do have a strong sort of thing about air travel, and yes, there is a hell of a lot of air travel going on, and there must be planes traveling at different heights all the time, and that is really true, and that is really interesting. And I don't know what to think about it, but you don't have to be an expert on everything. You know what I mean? Like, you maybe it's an area you have looked into, maybe it's an area you haven't looked into, maybe you're just putting forward a hypothesis at the moment. And it's an interesting hypothesis. And that's what I have to say about that.
Mm-hmm. But I still like you to, I still suggest that anyone, anywhere in the world, when they see it, when they see a day with a lot of hazy trails in the sky, that they actually, they actually look at the meteorological charts, and they'll see that there's, high pressure system, and that then the jet stream trail is, which is a meteorological jet stream, is not happening over them. So it's not blowing it away. What's amazing to me is
some people are saying that there's a lot of evidence. The people in chat right now, it's a shame you're not in there, are saying that there's a lot, that there's a lot of evidence. The chemicals are being sprayed. They've been analyzed. The climate engineering is synonymous with geoengineering. When I look up and see chemtrails, I try not to deny them. One thing in the same, geoengineering. So a lot of people think it is geoengineering. So, you know, I think it was a bit of a curly question to put in there, because we're really talking about permaculture. I didn't even think it was a pertinent question to ask when I asked it, but I asked it because a couple of people asked to ask it.
I don't mind, but I'd still invite all of these people who want to worry about chemtrails to consider, firstly, the meteorological conditions, and to secondly, consider whether they might be better worrying about the amount of air travel that's happening, just simple domestic air travel. And actually, it may be easier to reduce to take actions to encourage people to reduce their air travel rather than to worry about the chemtrails. But, whether or not the geoengineering is happening, and I'm quite willing to accept that some of it is happening, but why worry about it? Because what can you actually do about it? There are so many other things you can do rather than get stressed about that particular one.
Yeah, I think it was a silly. I think it was, I wish I had ignored that, but I decided not to, because I thought it was way off track to do
permaculture. Oh, no, I don't think it's that off track, because for me, what's important in permaculture is you work where it counts. Working where it counts means doing things where you can have an effect. This is why you can have a lot of effect on your local economy by growing a surplus of local food. Now, of course, you can argue that if that food is polluted because of geoengineering in the sky, or if it's destroyed because someone builds a freeway through your garden, all of those bigger picture things can damage your happy local economy. But if you don't get the local economy right, then you're stuffed anyway. So I don't mind people taking notice and commenting on their concerns about chemtrails or so on. But are those people actually growing food in the local garden? Are they sharing their surpluses with their neighbors? And aren't they actually better spent putting their energy into that rather than being concerned about things that you can actually wait, that you can't have much effect on?
Yeah, well, I completely agree with that, and I see your point, and I see their point too, because you know it's all part of the discussion, but and it's part of the permaculture. I mean, it's part of our system, and chemtrails are part of our system. In America, I think it's in Ireland. We're in a very unpopulated place. Like between you and me, how many people would there be? Like you're half an hour's drive away from me, 25 minutes drive away from me, and between you and me.
But I live under the main flight path of out of Melbourne Airport, which is hundreds of flights every day, and we're crisscrossed by planes going around the world from east to west as well. Now, and we're in a country with 20 million. You need to multiply that by about 15 times when you're looking at North America. So that you've got to allow for all of these millions of flights that are happening just from normal domestic traffic. I know that we're in a relatively quiet area, which confirms to me that if you're living in the Northern Hemisphere, you're going to see a lot more normal air traffic above you, and that some days the normal pollution, those trails out the back of your 747s and your 707s and your 777s, that's pollution too. If you're seeing a lot of that in the sky, then that's
something.
A lot of stop flying. Well, that's because a lot of that traffic, a lot of that domestic air traffic, is what's called discretionary. It's business flights that people don't have to make, and it's domestic flights that people don't have to make. Especially when you've got things like Skype, this wonderful medium that we're on at the moment. And what I have done, Jill, is I've posted a link and some dot points about the Bristol Pound. And I've also posted to you a link about the Transition Network. And that these are two great places that people can go. So will you be able to repost them to the chat room?
I've reposted one already now.
One's
going in now. Is this man not considering his precious oil is being rained down upon? Don't even bother answering this. How does he plan on growing food in soil that is dead, polluted by fracking and other environmental issues? It's all interrelated. And, yes, it is interrelated, Lee, but the point is, I think you're missing the point too, because basically it's one part of an enormous picture. There's an enormous amount of problems in this world. And I really think one of the biggest problems, it's nice, you know, that we're looking up at the sky and it's terrible that we are polluting the sky. But I think, you know, even if you take it right back, the thing that's dawning on me again and again is the importance of eudaimonia. Like, in, you know, the Greeks' highest sort of state that one can achieve is some sort of affinity with nature. And I think it's really important that we do keeping our fingers in the soil. I'm actually did the dishes, but last night. And I've been dying to put my hands in the sink because I had so much chook poop, you know, chicken manure under my fingernails. And I love it. I think we've just got to get more dirt under our fingers and be creating the things it's funny, for some reason I was want to think of, you know, like vegetables, you know, they're vegetation for the table. And it's so important that we just do, you know, get our hands in the soil and create things that actually offset a lot of these things too. Like if we can start getting our bugs back in our gardens and our birds back in our gardens and which other people have proven they have in their gardens. I mean, I've got a very wild bird life here. Stephen can attest to that. He's always amazed at all the birds that are flying around outside my door and he can hear on radio. But yes, chemtrails, we've got problems all over the place, but what can we do about it? We can begin locally and we can begin in our own backyard and on our own windowsill. And I think that's just really, really important.
Yeah, look, in answer to those points.
Don't bother answering.
No, no. Well, I'm not answering them head on. I'm reinforcing your points. The concerns that people express, whether it's about chemtrails, fracking, global warming, or whatever, can easily lead people either to depression or to paranoia or to some kind of, you know, some deep-seated fear. It's natural that we have fear of these things. Yeah. If you're finding yourself depressed or fearful, then my answer is to say you've got to get focused on solutions.
Exactly.
And that doing permaculture is quite simply solutions-focused. One of the reasons for success of permaculture and the viral spread of permaculture is that it appeals to people who are solutions focused. You can put up as many posts on Facebook as you like about your fears about Facebook or your fears about chemtrails or your fears about bushfire that's going to burn through your place or whatever. Or you can actually go out and do something that's practical, constructive, creative, and so on. Now, of course, at times there are times when you'll come up against the big system and it's going to make it impossible for you to put your particular solution in place. But that's actually a learning experience. That's actually telling you you're probably in the wrong place and you need to take a different approach to whatever it is you're trying to do.
Yeah, and it is like multidimensional because we need to look after our spirit, you know, like it's like you said, you begin your meditation, you know, with your breath or what you call the flame, but you know, that you bring yourself back, you bring your mind home. I just think that's so important, just to bring the mind home and be here now, like be in where we are and work out from that center. And that's a permacultural principle too, isn't it? But you begin in the home. You begin
start at the back door and work outwards. But you can make it even more about starting with yourself and working outwards. So there's actually very strong links between permaculture and yoga, or permaculture and spiritual traditions. Without, this is probably a discussion for another week, because I'm not sure how long your slot goes for, but I've run out of time anyway.
We've gone over time. Stephen's been has been very gracious, and so we've run out of time. You're a very, very busy man. And thank you so much for coming, Stephen Lillington. And I wouldn't mind giving your book a plug.
Ian Lillington. Would you give your book
a plug? Ian. Did I call you Stuart? Did you become Stuart?
No,
this time?
You called him Stephen.
Stephen Lillington.
Well, Stephen Lillington. That's a great name, isn't it?
And Ian welcome. Roberts.
Yes. You go on, Jill. You can wind up and we'll talk again soon.
All right. What's the name of your book? Just tell me one more time.
The book is called The Holistic Life, and it's a beginner's guide to permaculture, and it's still available by internet mail. You can buy it through the internet if you search The Holistic Life.
So there you are. So search The Holistic Life, everybody. And Ian Lillington, thank you for coming and talking about so many things and bringing our mind home.
You're welcome.
Good night, everyone. Thanks very much. Night.